So again, good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. So as I mentioned earlier, for those of you who weren't on yet, this morning's meditation, Dharma talk, coincides with the fifth morning of a five-day retreat, a wisdom retreat. Simplicity and ease are available right now. The teachings of the great perfection tradition. Those of you who are somewhat familiar with Buddhism, you know there are many, many different teachings and practices in Buddhism. But there is an end game. And the end game is not that we are great erudite professors of all the teachings and practices of Buddhism. That is not the end game. That is not the fruit. The teachings and the practices are the means to becoming a certain kind of person. In this retreat, we talked about a person who lives in simplicity and ease. That's just one way of saying it. Another way could be where we become wise human beings, intelligent human beings, discerning human beings. We become good human beings. We become loving and compassionate and caring human beings, patient and understanding with ourselves and all others. This is the end game. And we always have to realize it's not about mastery of the teachings and practices. It's through the mastery of the teachings and practices that we transform. In Buddhism, that transformation is, you know, we begin as a deluded human being and we end up an enlightened human being. We begin as a human being confused, unclear, lost in our own stories, lost in our own delusions, lost in our own sufferings. And unable to really live our potential or really manifest and act the way in the world that we want to. We always seem to get tripped up. After a process, we end up an enlightened being, someone who has liberated themselves from all their sufferings, all their delusions, all their hang-ups, all their neuroses, all their negativity. And we are just manifesting the innate wisdom, goodness, clarity, wisdom of that is our potential right now. So it must be clear that the difference between an ordinary human being and a Buddha is not the body. It's not the physicality. We all look the same. And we actually all have the same mind. But the mind of a Buddha has been transformed. That's what's been transformed. And because the mind has been transformed, one's life has been transformed. And so that is why in Buddhism, because the very source of our happiness and unhappiness, the very source of our suffering and our non-suffering. All arises in the mind. Buddhism puts a lot of focus on the mind. That's why meditation is very central, and study is very central, because we want to change the way the mind thinks, the way the mind views itself and the world around it, so it has greater understanding and discernment. And through our meditation, our mindfulness, our concentration, we are developing tools that will then give us the capacity of going through this process of transformation. If we don't have the tools, then we can't do anything, really. We need tools. If we're going to garden, if we have to garden with our bare hands, it's difficult and laborious. But if we have good garden tools, there's still work to be done, but it's a lot easier. Try digging a deep hole with your hands sometime. So in our community, we have many tools and many teachings, and we develop them, and so they have a developmental development to them. We have our mindful living path, our foundation path, where we learn to stabilize the mind in mindful awareness. Learn there is such a thing as a present moment and that we try to live in it more and more. Learn the basics of calming and stabilizing the mind, and also emphasize emotional healing. It's very hard to learn how to swim in 6-foot waves. It's very hard to calm and stabilize the mind if our life, our minds are still always roiled by emotional reactivity and all kinds of dramas, and you know what I mean. So, we have to attend to this. And luckily, fortunately, we have good tools to do that. In the next level, we learn the Dharma. We go deeper into calm abiding meditation. We learn about the four immeasurables. We learn about and practices to cultivate a loving heart, a compassionate heart, a caring heart. We learn basic teachings of Buddhism. Everything is impermanent. Everything is changing. Sickness, old age, and death are normal, part of everybody's experience. We learn about why worldly life, a life that is always seeking outside itself, always seeking pleasure, always avoiding pain, always seeking happiness, fulfillment by grabbing at external experiences and holding on to them. Why that whole, and I could say obviously a lot more, we learn why that there's nothing wrong with us if we're doing all that right, and yet we're still depressed, or yet we're still anxious, or we still deep down inside don't feel fulfilled. Somehow it's, when the music ends, when the party's over, when the object has been achieved, why when we're alone, it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel whole and peaceful and complete. There's always this dissatisfaction. And of course, either we get some medical treatment for our dissatisfaction, or we go shopping, or we go have sex, or we, drink or drug, we do all kinds of things, or else we just look for something else to pursue. Still thinking that it's outside us. But in practicing the Dharma path, and it's all on the website, and many of you know it, we learn to change our view. We get a better sense of what's really going on. And so we have greater discernment in our actions in life, and life becomes better. But there often is one central issue that we haven't really got into yet. And that is, up to now, our learning has been primarily conceptual and intellectual, combined with some degree of meditative experience in terms of stabilizing and calming the mind. But if we remember, in the earliest teachings of the Buddha, he talked about the three marks of existence, two of which were impermanence and dukkha, unsatisfactoriness. But the third was anatta, non-self. And in Buddhism, the Buddha said always, the fundamental misperception that causes beings to suffer is they have this strong, all-encompassing identification that what feels like a self, what feels like a me, is a real solid thing. And because of that, we completely identify as a solid, permanent, autonomous self over space and time. The me of childhood is the me of today. The stories of my experiences of childhood are my experiences now. There is this sense that at the center of my life, there is a solid me. And because of that, we enter the world always with the self grasping. It's grasping for something. It's grasping because it doesn't intrinsically exist, as the Buddha says, but because we want it to exist, we think we exist, we're always grasping at things that can give us a sense we're alive. Pleasure gives us a momentary sense of we're alive. Success, achievement, getting something, having something, owning something. I'm alive, I have something. There's something tangible here. And the me, this me that fundamentally doesn't exist, is always endlessly, endlessly grasping at the world, seeking happiness, seeking to avoid unhappiness. Seeking pleasure, seeking to avoid boredom or non-pleasure or pain. Seeking success, wanting to avoid failure. Seeking to be loved, afraid of being not loved or disliked. Wanting to be known, unhappy when unknown. You know, the endless drama of self that we all participate in to a greater degree. Over time, some of us may get weary of the dance of self. Because it's not a smooth dance. You know, it's like dancing with a bad dancer. You know, it's just not a good dance. We're always kind of bumping into each other, stepping on toes. You're going one way, your partner's going the other way. It's like it just never feels right. So we know about, fundamental teachings of Dharma is the teaching of non-self. It doesn't exist. We don't really get it, but we understand it. But certainly at the Dharma level, we learn a lot about, being less selfish, being less self-centered, less narcissistic. And so often at the Dharma level, through various kinds of actions, we are that way, which is good. But still, the central core of identification, we still believe where we are, I am me. I am Fred, and he exists. But perhaps through the practice of up to now, he's a nicer Fred, a less self-centered Fred. And so we pat Fred on the back. You're doing better, Fred. And Fred is very happy to be patted on the back for all his efforts in Dharma. You see, it's still, self is still at the center of things. Right? So we have the wisdom path, and the wisdom path comes from the Buddha. While there are many traditions and lineages, they all come from the Buddha because it was the Buddha who, after 6, 7, 9 years of going around northern India, taking all kinds of teachings, learning all kinds of meditative trance systems, and having all kinds of spiritual experiences, when they were all over, and he came back to himself, he realized that fundamentally, that sense of separation, that sense of being a self independent and separate from others, was still there. And so he himself, he was the first, we might say, who realized, I have to put it all down. All the teachings, all the experiences, all the meditative experiences I've had, I have to put them all down. Stop. And we know he just stopped in Bodh Gaya, sat under the Bodhi tree, and he just devoted himself single-mindedly to looking directly into his own mind, to resolve once and for all these more intellectual issues of self and non-self. What is the true nature of things? Who am I? Who am I really? See, we could ask somebody, who are you? And they'll tell you all the things they are. I was born here, I did this, this is my third grade teacher, these were my parents, this was this is what happened, what kind of teenager I was, this is that, this is where I went to school, these are my degrees, these are my certifications, these are things I'm good at, these are things I'm bad at, these are my good relationships, these are my bad relationships. You know what I mean? We could, right? Endlessly. But the real issue is, who is that one who is telling the story? Who am I? What is that? You see? Is that me? Who am I? What am I? And so in the wisdom path, which is a lineage, I mean, in manifest terms, the teaching I gave this time was come from the great perfection tradition, which is a long tradition that comes to us from Tibet, but actually came to Tibet from India, from teachers in India. Another great wisdom tradition is Zen. Zen is the Japanese for Chan, Chinese. And where do you think Chan came from? India, right? So, and you know, what is the source of Indian Buddhism and this path of wisdom teachings and practices? Shakyamuni Buddha. So, you know, they manifest in different ways, but they all go back to India, and in India they all go back to the Buddha. So they're just various traditions. Having trained both in Zen and the Great Perfection, you know, I'm somewhat conversant with both, practicing them both. But I often find that the Great Perfection, because it has a little more structure, a little more instructions, a little more guidance. Over the years, I found that it really is a very useful path for people like us. Let me say that, you know, In the days of old, people would go to their teacher, teacher would tell them what to do, and they'd go off and do it. See you in a year or two. Come back and tell, you know, come back and talk to me when you have realization or something to report. I don't think that's the way we operate, is it? So I think having a wisdom path that kind of gives us more structure and support to me works better. So over the years, I've really begun to practice more of these great perfection texts than more traditional Zen texts. Not because they don't have the same wisdom and aren't really teaching the same thing and aren't bringing us to the same place. But it's really sort of the process is a little different. So we just had a 5-day wisdom retreat, not a lot. And I have asked four people, just sort of on a random basis, just this morning when we were doing our closing circle, just asked four people who participated to share their experience. I've picked people that are fairly new to the community, or maybe this was their first wisdom, people who've been to several, some who live here, some live out of state, to share their experience with us. But basically, just the structure of retreat, obviously with Zoom. Fortunately, there were five other people in the hall with me, so I wasn't just speaking to a camera, and they sort of supported the audiovisual on the bell, helped me with when I wasn't in the hall to do guided meditations, made food so we could all eat together formally. But pretty much everybody else there, I think there were 48 people, everybody else was at home. And basically, you know, we observed the protocols of silence, the protocols of, you know, turning off your phones, your computer. And I have to make a full confession at this moment. I have no idea what's going on in the news. Isn't that interesting? I have not heard the news. I don't say what's going on in the world because the news is not what's going on in the world. The news is very tiny, tiny little focus pieces of what's going on. So I just call it the news because I understand other people are making choices about what we receive. So I have not heard, I just want to report, I am totally unaware of what's going on in the world. I have not heard the news. And I don't believe, hopefully, I would ask everybody else not to. I'm looking around at them. And I just want to report, we are well. just want to, in case you're a little worried about us, you know, and I just want to report, we are well and everybody's good. Okay, I just want to share that insight, okay? It is possible. The morning began at 6:30 and the day ended at 9. And there were basically every day four, 1.5, 2 or 3 hour sessions, formal sessions that everybody had to participate in. And they were sessions of teaching and meditation. That was the heart. Otherwise, people had breaks to prepare their own food, to rest, to meditate on their own, periods of solitary retreat. And we had a half hour of mindful movements, sort of Qigong kind of movements. Some people led. And that was our retreat for 5 days in silence. I shared teachings from a Dzogchen teacher, a great perfection teacher who lived in Tibet into the 20s, so not that old, long ago, not like ancient. And the way I had heard about him, there was a very brilliant Tibetan teacher who came out of Tibet in the diaspora in the late 50s. and taught an American taught in the West named Digo Chensi Rinpoche, quite famous. And Shashin Gyatsub, whose teaching I shared, was his teacher. So there is a kind of an historical reference, and this was a text on just a collection of short teachings, letters that he had written. So I just shared actually one of them and made that the focus of the teachings, because in the wisdom tradition, you have a lot of what are called pith teachings, which means there's not a lot of explanation. There's some explanation, but it's mostly what to do with your mind. And so what are we doing with our mind? We're investigating the mind. We are turning in. Mostly the mind is just endlessly following the things that appear in it. It follows the things it sees, it smells, it tastes, it hears. We're endlessly following, and we're endlessly thinking. We're endlessly chasing our thoughts, following our thoughts all day, unconsciously. And wherever they go, we follow. In a wisdom retreat, we stop the outflow and we go in to the very mind that is generating the thoughts, to the very mind that is generating all the things that appear in the mind. And so we look into directly, what is the nature of my mind? What is the nature of a thought? Looking directly at a thought, what is a thought? And most significantly, looking for the self. Because if the self really exists, it has to exist somewhere within my body mind. So we search deeply within our mind for all these things we think are there to see the true reality of things. And we also discover deep within our mind this innate, undefiled awareness. Our true awareness before thought, pure, uncontaminated, fully alive, really the basis of everything, our true home. And people have an experience of that, very liberating, to know who and what you really are. So I have asked four people just to share, totally unrehearsed. I just asked them a little bit ago, didn't tell them what to say, other than just share their experience that, you know, with their brothers and sisters on the path. Again, some people, it might have been the first wisdom retreat. Other people may have done many. You know, they may want to share with you, you know, how this retreat is different than other retreats. They may want to share with you what their experience was like being on a wisdom retreat for them. So why don't we begin with Mitch, because Mitch is sort of newer to our community, and I believe this was his first wisdom retreat. Mitch, you're there somewhere?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, and so they're going to spotlight you so everybody can see you. Just give us another moment here.
Tell me when I'm on. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Hello? I'm on? Okay. Let me just see. Somebody give me a thumbs up so I know that.
Yeah, you're okay, Mitch. We're just trying to spotlight you or do something like that or pin you. Okay. Everybody can see you now, Mitch.
Okay, good.
So you have 3 to 5 minutes, but just take your time.
Good. So actually, Fred, I came to the community. I know when you look at some of the members like Alex and Sam and Marilyn, I'm a newcomer. But I first came to FCM in 2016. So I'm in my fifth year, became a member shortly after coming to Sangha for a couple of months. And I remember my first interview with you. I came in the lower level of the Sangha and talked to you about my chronic pain, because I had a severe injury about 8 years ago and I have a 4-level fusion in my neck. And I remember you asking me, and you listened to me talk for a couple of minutes, and then you said to me, "Who is this that's telling me this story about what happened?" And I was totally taken aback. I had to think for a minute, and I think I may have guessed at the answer, partly maybe based on some of Eckhart Tolle teachings, and I think I responded to you, "It's the observer," almost in the form of a question. And you smiled and shook your head. And that was the beginning of my journey. And I have done a lot of work over the last 5 years, I would say. You know, I've and probably have followed the path the way it was meant to be laid out. I went through mindful living intensives and classes and retreats. I've probably done about 2 retreats a year, give or take, since I became a member. More on the mindful living and Dharma path. There may have been one wisdom retreat along the way, the Bodhidharma retreat. I'm not sure if that's Dharma or was wisdom, but they were shorter. They were 3-day retreats or 4-day retreats. And I think I would not, had I taken this retreat 3 or 4 years ago, I don't think I would have gotten, you know, 20% of maximum of what I got out of it now. So I think one of my reflections is really following the path the way it's laid out is really very meaningful way to build on all one's learning. In this specific retreat, on day one, I was sharing with you with the small group how I thought I was using it and how I wanted to start using it. And you smiled and said, "Mitch, you're now in the, where pretend you're scuba diving and spend 5 days underwater. Don't worry about getting your pictures developed and who you're going to show them to yet or what you're going to, how you're going to use it." And that metaphor was very helpful for me in really going deep. And I think some of the things that I took away from it and that were different for me than the past retreats were, it's a lot more work when you're turning and looking back at yourself than just hearing teachings and sitting in meditation. I mean, obviously the practice of looking at ourselves was through meditative practice. But it had a lot more structure to it that was very meaningful and helpful for me. I think several of the things I learned was not to chase my thoughts. I think I realized that I do naturally find places of resting in awareness in between thoughts. But I don't think I realized I was doing that. And I don't think I knew how to help myself do it. I didn't have the tools to necessarily do it myself. And there was another metaphor you used that was very powerful for me. I think a Japanese Zen master of, we have to be careful when we spill some blood, not to take a blood-stained rag and try and clean it up. And I realized that many times when I'm dealing with my own afflictive emotions, and start chasing those thoughts and get caught up in that cycle of samsara, that's exactly what I'm doing. So the things we learned were very helpful for me to take a step back and just create more space and let that thought go. And So that was very powerful. One of the challenges I had a little bit during the practice at the beginning was being very prescriptive about the instruction and following it. And I think the combination of Angie's suggestion and your guidance of make it your own, and also just realizing that it's not as hard, you don't have to make it harder than it is. Just relax into it, you know, and the process will unfold for itself. And it started to do that for me. I think the other thing that I really found helpful is the structure of the practice that I'm going to take back with me. I often sit down, and sometimes I'll think about my intention or the four thoughts that turn the mind, but sometimes I don't, or I go straight into shamatha meditation, but I'm doing it to relax my body, but I'm not really doing any investigation. And the framework that was shared with us was really helpful. And I think as you were just pointing out, one of the things I've been obsessing about has been the state of the world and our country. And I think disconnecting for these 5 days and not thinking about that, almost, I'd say very little at all. Maybe once or twice that thought came into my head about what's going on out there. And it did not have that same emotional effect on me. It's just, oh, that's out there, you know. Things are happening in the world, you know. Yes, I need to care about them, but I don't need to get pulled into them in the same way. They are inherently empty, I think I'm going to go back into the world with different reactions to some of the things I might see and hear on the news. And I also think I'm going to watch and listen to the news a lot less, because one of the other things I got out of this was the preciousness of practice and, you know, how precious our human life is, as we've been learning through Shantideva, and the importance of using that time wisely. And there are people doing wonderful work on MSNBC and all the other places, but I don't need to be immersed in it the way I occasionally allow myself to get pulled in. So I guess I would sum it up by saying I feel like I went to the eye doctor a couple of months ago after not having gone for 2 years, and my vision had been fine, but when he examined me, he said, wow, your prescription has really changed. I guess your eyes have weakened. And I said, I didn't really notice that much. I don't notice myself straining. But all of a sudden, when I got my new glasses, it was like, whoa, I can see a lot more clearly. And I feel that way with some of the practices we've learned, but I also feel that way with even some of the other teachings. Like over the last few days, I went back to where I'm in the Shantideva intensive. So I went back and read some of that, or I have some of the mind training cards nearby, and I looked at them and I saw them differently, because some of the Dzogchen teaching is inherent in that, and I did not see it in a three-dimensional way before. So I think the richness of the practice of all the teachings coming together is something that's going to be really powerful. And I guess the last thing I'll say is I came in with that chronic pain, and I now, I don't know if you noticed in this retreat, I wasn't grabbing my neck. I wasn't suffering the way I have in the past. And it made me realize that that's also a reflection of me having a different relationship to that pain, even though it's still there. And I'm pretty active and physical, you know, bike riding every day now. So I think the practice has really helped me.
Thank you, Mitch. Thank you. Next is Jana. Jana, probably most people don't know. Jana actually was a member of the Naples Community of Mindfulness thousands of years ago when I was in Naples and began there. And then many thousands of years ago, she relocated to New Mexico. She's really been sort of a long distance member for quite a while now. So Jana, can you please share your experience from this retreat?
Thank you, Fred. I moved away from Florida about 10 years ago. From that point, every year when it was time to renew membership, I would think about it and think, wouldn't it be so much easier just to be involved in a Sangha here? But how can anyone walk away from Fred's teachings? So here I am 10 years later. I have attended a few retreats back there at the Franciscan Center, I think it's called. And I will always attend any retreat that Fred is scheduling because they're so deeply meaningful and I have to say enlightening, not that I feel I'm anywhere close to enlightenment. Because I have my issues. We all have our issues, all different. Probably the one issue that I'm guessing we all share is the desire to live a life of meaning, to help ourselves, to be a benefit to our families and to others, or even just to express the gratitude for the life that we have. So that's something I'm guessing we have in common. As for me, I have many, many other issues. And until I went on my first retreat, I didn't even know what all my issues were. And that first retreat, it was just a weekend long. It was there not too far from Tampa at Chincoget, which is a wildly beautiful place, run down in a sense, but grown wild and beautiful. The grounds themselves are spacious, which just kind of reinforced the practice that we were involved in there. But one of the issues that I uncovered just on the way to that retreat was how much anxiety I carried with me. This was a big realization for me because I thought I was such a chill, easygoing person. Not at all. I was flipping out as I was driving to that retreat, wondering, what is a retreat? What is a Buddhist retreat? Why did I sign up for it? Why am I going? Why don't I just turn around? I even, when I had my first one-on-one with Fred, I actually yelled at him. And I'm sure he might have been thinking in his mind, maybe I should schedule this person for counseling rather than another retreat. but that's who I was. Mitch, I had to stop watching the news way back then because I yelled at the TV too. That kind of tells you where I started on this path. What I learned from that weekend that made me realize the need to continue practicing was this need to uncover all of those issues. Hopefully to uncover those issues. I'll tell you why I have my phone in front of me later in a second. And as I've come to learn, it's all about peeling back the layers of the detritus of modern life. That's what these retreats accomplish for me. I've been on retreat with Fred at Southern Dharma. I would love to go back there every year. I hope that will be possible in the not too distant future. I've achieved some deep realizations in the course of attending the various retreats that I have. We all understand how beneficial the weekly meditations are with the Sangha, our solo practice at home, the intensives that Florida Mindfulness has, and the frequency that they occur with. It's such a blessing to have access to these teachings and practices. And I guess it occurs to me, I almost hate to say this, given the all of the suffering that is happening with the pandemic, but the silver lining I see in it is that these teachings are now so much more accessible through the Zoom technology. And the fact that Florida Mindfulness has taken a full benefit of that and is providing more and more of this online is very helpful and meaningful to me, being so distant geographically. Fred is often telling us the stories of the ascetics who live in caves or for years of toil and degradation, they come to great awareness. And I don't think we're different people than those ancient sages. But I think that if we truly want to let go, I find this for myself, to be able to truly let go of those many issues, and to do what is most important to me in life, which is to be of service to others, that a retreat is required. It deepens my awareness. Today happens to be my birthday. And so friends and family are calling me to wish me a happy birthday, and to find out how I'm going to celebrate. And I'm not 8 years old, so a birthday celebration is not real important to me. I tend to be more an introspective person, so a celebration of my birthday is not a fun thing to me to do. And so it's hard even to think of what's a kind way to respond to those greetings and questions. If I say, I'm practicing solo, they're going to wonder what that even means and why I would do such a thing on my birthday. But so as I say, every retreat, I find that I deepen my awareness. What was special to me about this retreat is realizing awareness itself. It is that simple, as Fred told us. It is that simple. Fred's teaching made me understand that practice is actually simpler than breathing. And I know that I have to keep going on retreat. In fact, the next retreat I'm going on is in a couple weeks at Upaya, which is just north of here. It'll also be on Zoom. And that's why I have my phone in front of me. Roshi Joan Halifax has a saying that she closes every session at Upaya with. And it reads, "Let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time passes swiftly, and opportunity is lost. Let us awaken, awaken, take heed. Do not squander your life." So those are words to live up to. And this being my 67th birthday, I may well have far less time than many of you. So I really have to be mindful of that. Fred's teachings, especially with this very meaningful retreat this week, have made me realize that the tools that Fred referenced this morning can only be obtained by me and hopefully mastered on retreat and the practice after retreat. So Fred, I just want to thank you so deeply for making these teachings accessible to me.
Thank you. Thank you, Jana. Next, Chris. Chris is a younger member, sort of began with the Wake Up Group and lives in Fort Myers. Lives and works and is married in Fort Myers. Chris, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Just give our AV team a chance to pin you or spotlight you. There you go. Yes, Chris.
Spent the last 5 days trying to pin Chris. So I understand that struggle.
Trying to pin him down, eh?
Yes. So this retreat was on simplicity and ease, and it's the best kind of retreat. Sometimes, you know, there's teachings where there's a lot of like stuff to learn. You have to five of this or six of this, or when, you know, anger arises, you do this. When fear arises, you do this. But in this retreat, when I was reflecting, I don't think I really had to learn much outside of myself. It was pretty simple and full of ease. For the most part, I just had to stop trying to figure things out. I spend most of my day in my job or my life trying to always figure things out. And so 5 days of not trying to figure things out, that is worth its weight in gold right there of simplicity and ease. And so, you know, the instructions were simple. We're just put things down, stop trying to do something, stop trying to, you know, get in the way, just put things down and look and rest. And I remember thinking, I can do those things. Like my dog's here with me the whole retreat. And like, he can do those things. He's been resting and looking at things and resting. And so it was like, oh, this is pretty easy. This is something that I can do. I can put things down. I can look and I can rest. I think the only real challenging thing was learning how to look, which direction to look. Which you talked about turning and looking inward. You know, I'm so caught up with looking in one direction the whole time. And instead just look inward, getting to know myself, getting to see what are these thoughts? What is this Chris that I think is always, you know, here, but when I look for him, I can't find him. And just looking and then resting. And when I do that and I don't hold on, there's just, the self is no longer the central player and there's just space. There's just space. It's just like right now, you know, there's TV on, right? There's TV going through, but my TV's not on. You know, I'm not concerned. Like there could be a commercial on for this or that, but I'm just not concerned with it because I'm here at the Sangha and sharing and talking. And so the practice was kind of as simple as that. It was just, one morning I was so tired and cranky and I didn't want to be there. And I say that like it's me, but it was just thoughts. Oh, it'd be nice to go back to sleep. Oh, it'd be nice to keep my eyes closed. It'd be nice to do that. And like he said, just no matter what is there, just let it be. Okay, so right now thoughts are, you know, being tired are there. That can't, that, you know, I can still look and I can still see that part of me that is awake right now that recognizes, hey, there's thoughts of tiredness. And so whether I'm sitting out by the lake or it's in the morning and I'd rather be sleeping, I can still do these same practices of just leaving things alone, looking deeply, and then resting. And so that was just such a wonderful 5 days.
Angie is one of our senior members, older member. I think she's been part of the community for over 20 years. So I'm interested to hear from Angie about her experience at this wisdom retreat.
It was a wonderful retreat, as others have shared. And despite having been on a few wisdom retreats, there's always something new to learn. And there were quite a few new things for me to learn on this retreat. We began by looking at aspiration, and some of the opening instructions in the text were, you know, do I really want to turn away from samsara? And what I learned was I look at my aspirations a lot, my spiritual aspirations, but what I really hadn't looked at is how much juice do I give my worldly aspirations, and how much are those getting in the way and being obstacles and dispersing my energy? You know, and there's an area of my life with my family that I think I just unconsciously had elevated to something very, very important. And I realized, you know, it doesn't matter if it's something that feels wholesome or not. I was still attaching to samsara in a way by being so focused on wanting this one thing to happen. And it was really taking energy away. And I realized I want the inner peace. I want to walk this bodhisattva path. And by not seeing these of unseen aspirations in my worldly life, those were obstacles. So that was really, really helpful for me to see that. And I became very clear on my priorities and just feel so committed to the practice. As others have shared, we did a lot of practices that really helped us uncover this natural aware mind that we have, and one that was somewhat humorous for me that I've done many times, but I got an opportunity to do it a little differently this retreat is, you know, when self comes up and feels strong, to turn and look, you know, can you find that self? And in particular, on Tuesday, the day of retreat, I learned that the person who was supposed to chant because of unavoidable circumstances couldn't come into the hall. And I couldn't convince any of the guys to chant. And Fred said, you'll do it. And I thought, oh my God, I am not someone who chants. But I've learned to trust my teacher and just to say yes. And so, you know, when that self-consciousness would come up during retreat, which it did quite strongly the first few days, particularly as I'd hear my own voice kind of coming out, you know, just looking at that, you know, who was there? And it was a very real looking for self and nothing there. And then I just watched that self-consciousness just, you know, basically disappear. All of this practice really brought us into that place of just this, as Fred says. And a difference for me in this retreat from other retreats I've done in the past is that very often I come into retreat looking for this place, this awareness, this natural mind, and I'm looking through my thoughts. And this time, because of, I think, the teachings and maybe just finally, you know, my own stubborn mind, just putting it all down, just coming to rest. It's real total simplicity and ease of just this present moment. And in that moment, my experience was there's not a me, there's the looker, there's no thoughts. And then I saw the thoughts so clearly as they come up as just mental projections, whether I was just putting a label on something or thinking about something. But I felt like instead of being in the thoughts, trying to touch awareness, I felt like I was just in the simplicity and watching what arises. And it's, you know, sometimes something perhaps needs to be followed up on, but most of the time, no, it's just noticing and not having to do a thing about it other than just recognizing the thoughts as empty for what they are. So very liberating. I feel very inspired and I'm very grateful, you know, for the teachings and also for the Sangha. It's just wonderful to have, you know, all the brothers and sisters. So I hope everyone here has the opportunity to experience retreats with us in this way. Thank you.
To Mitch and Chris and Jana and Angie for sharing your experiences. If for people who are in the hall, the virtual hall, who are at retreat, it's always good to hear, because again, we don't have a great opportunity to talk with each other during retreat. So it's just very interesting to listen to each other and for you to share your experience. And for those of you who were obviously, most of you who weren't on retreat, it was an opportunity just to get a sense of what goes on, you know, at a wisdom retreat. So this is the process, you see. And it is, again, it is very hard for us as Americans because of the way we, our minds have been constructed by all the causes and conditions of our society, that the idea of a spiritual path as being transformative, not just therapeutic, you see. I think we, because our psychological world is dominated by the enshrinement of a self, the ego, and that the process, the therapeutic process, is to create a little more ease for the ego, a little less difficulty, a little more functionality, right? And that, and to have more of that is sort of our goal, to be less stressful, less reactive, right? Less caught up in our issues. That really, at the base, is sort of what we think. It's, you know, even though we call it a spiritual path, it's really, for most of us, a therapeutic path. A little more mindfulness. A little more presence. A little more calmness. You see, I often have referred to that in the past as, you know, for many of us, we begin in minimum or max, I mean, medium or maximum security prison, right? And so, you know, trying to work our way to minimum security prison is a great. We go, oh, this is much better, right? It's a little quieter. The people are a little nicer. You know what I mean? It's and we don't realize that we're still in prison. We're still not free. And so the Buddhist path is a path of liberation from suffering. It is a path of enlightenment. Enlightenment means that we are enlightened. It's not like there's some like thing called enlightenment, you know, like a great light turns on, but we're enlightened to the true nature of things. And one of the things you heard people share, we're enlightened to the truth is, not just non-self is some kind of concept opposed to self, but that upon investigation into one's own mind, one can actually experience that there is no self as a direct experiential experience. And when one has it, it brings incredible relief throughout your whole body and mind. It's as if this thing we've been carrying around all our life and didn't even realize it. This thing that we didn't even realize, a central organizing principle of our life and our emotional life, relational life, doesn't exist in any real way. What a relief to experience that I'm not a separate, lonely, individualized, separated, disconnected self. That I really am everything. That I really am connected to everything. And that inside, there's really vast openness and spaciousness. And a naturally functioning good heart. And it was always here. It is always here. And, you know, again, I think one of our great diseases in our society with the misuse of our mind is we live in our thoughts. You know, there's probably never been a time. I mean, again, most historically, peoples were, they had much simpler lives. They were agricultural workers. They were farmers. They worked in factories. You know what I mean? We are our ancestors, you know, most people had not, you know, kind of non-conceptual doing. That's how they worked, you see. But many of us, we work with our thinking mind. And we receive an education, you know, and even public education in the history of human beings is fairly recent. You know, our minds are educated, lots of information, lots of facts. And of course, in this age of media, TVs, on up to now, you know, the thinking mind is just chronically stimulated and overstimulated. And yet, it is very simple in the wisdom path to learn how to look directly at a thought with the question, what is a thought? The most simplest, obvious question for those who've been led around by thoughts their whole life. To stop and look, what is the thought, that, what is this thing that's been leading me around? And if you look long and deep enough, you will see. It is nothing. It doesn't exist as any kind of separate autonomous reality. It is empty of any substance. Oh, now it's so easy just to let them come and go. You can even let the self thought, the I thought, the me thought, just let it go. It has no substance. Well, then you might ask, well, if I do that, what's left? You know, that could be pretty scary. Those are all the things I live in. There is something left. It's our natural awareness. Pure, undefiled, stainless, the source of all goodness. Beyond birth and death, that is who and what we really are. So the Buddhist journey, and we call that in Buddhism, we call that our true nature, our Buddha nature, our awakened nature. Other traditions call it different things. Still the same thing, just different names. So when we have some degree of insight, recognition of who and what we really are, and most importantly, who and what we're not. Our suffering comes from identifying from what we're really not. That's why it's endlessly problematic. But once we have an experience of this open, spacious, non-self, true nature, which is just our own natural mind. I mean, it's not extraordinary. Everyone has it. You're all listening to me with it. We just don't know that yet. But when you know it, then life becomes very different. How does it become? Simple and easy. And so no longer are simplicity and ease things we have to do to make happen. They're our natural state. Actually, in the great perfection, relaxation and not doing our core practices. You know, it's, we might say the teachings of the great perfection are very un-American. And that's why often these teachings are difficult for people, because the idea that we don't have to do anything, that we already are everything we want to be, and we just have to stop doing and just relax and look within. And again, as I've said to the people on retreat, that is so difficult. We are so addicted to endlessly looking out. Endlessly looking out. We cannot stop looking out from morning till night. And we never look in to look at the one who is actually looking. Who is it that is looking out through these eyes? Who is it that's watching the news? Who is it that's generating these thoughts? What is that? So that wisdom of truly knowing who you are, which is very simple. You don't need a PhD in Buddhism. You don't even need an MA. I mean, you could have a GED. Is that clear? Just as long as you have basic language abilities. That's all you need here. So, so this again, everyone on the call, you're at different levels of the path, but just to get a sense, it's a developmental path, it's a continuous path, and there are fruits all along the way in this path. Many of you have experienced them right from the beginning, but there is one great fruit, and that all of us have an opportunity to taste it in this life. So with that, I will end. This brings an end to the Dharma talk, and it brings an end to the retreat.